From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, you didn't have to be in Belgium to feel the reverberation of bombs in Brussels. British Prime Minister David Cameron.
These were attacks in Belgium. They could just as well be attacks in Britain or in France or Germany or elsewhere in Europe. And we need to stand together.
And French Prime Minister Manuel Valls said Europe's very survival is at stake.
C'est une autre guerre parce que...
It's another war because terrorism, this terrorism, Islamic State, wants to destroy us. It wants to destroy men and women. We've seen it.
Writing in The Guardian this week, French journalist Nicolas Henin criticized world leaders for depicting the challenge posed by ISIS this way. Quote, if we adopt a militaristic, warlike vocabulary, there'll be no way back from that. We will only strengthen our enemies, he wrote. Henin should know, in 2013, while reporting in Syria, he was kidnapped and held hostage by ISIS for nearly a year. He shared a cell with James Foley, Stephen Sotloff, Peter Kasich, and more than a dozen other Western captives. Mohamed Emwazi, better known as Jihadi John, an oft-videoed executioner, was one of his jailers. After Henin's release, filled with what he called accidental knowledge of jihadism, he wrote Jihad Academy. In the book, he punctures Western conventional wisdom about ISIS and the Syrian conflict and lays bare what he sees as our deadly misperceptions of ISIS. Nicholas, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So, you essentially make the argument that the West, and particularly the Western media, buy into the myths that ISIS is selling, right?
Yeah.
Let's go through some of them. A big one has to do with the relationship between the Syrian regime and ISIS.
No, that exactly.
The government,
we believe that they are enemies. They are not enemies. They cooperate together.
They cooperate together.
Of course.
Their relationship is symbiotic.
Yes. ISIS needs the regime to kill Syrians in huge numbers. So then ISIS can come and tell the Arab Sunnis in Syria, well, we are the bad guys, powerful enough to protect you. We are like your godfathers.
ISIS says that.
Yeah, ISIS says that. And the regime, meanwhile, needs ISIS as life insurance.
Life insurance?
Yes, of course. Because as long as ISIS is here, then, well, the West will be terrified and will say, well, maybe Bashar al-Assad is a lesser problem. This regime, which claims today that it fights terrorism, that it is secular, is nothing like that. All the foreign fighters who joined the Iraqi insurgency in the early years of the American occupation of Iraq, they all transited through Syria. And this transit was managed by the Syrian intelligence. The regime played with terrorism to, well, ensure its future.
We've seen the rise of ISIS making its capital right inside of Syria. And you're saying that was also according to Assad's plan. And that's something that we fail to understand, which is critical, right?
Yeah. Assad needs ISIS to survive. He released jihadi prisoners at the very early stages of the revolution. He declared an amnesty. But this amnesty did not concern all the Democrats. They stayed in prison. All the political prisoners in jail, they stayed in jail. But all the jihadists, they were released because he wanted a civil war. He wanted this revolution to become a civil war. And for the very same reason, he also created tremendous fear among the minorities in his country, so that the Syrian Christians, for instance, are convinced that if ever the revolution succeeds, then they will be either dead or will have to flee, which was at least at the beginning totally wrong. Yes, there is definitely now concerns for the future of the minorities in Syria. But at its early stage, it was just people begging for its freedom.
You also suggest that our misperceptions lead to actions, or the lack of actions, that actually create self-fulfilling prophecies.
For instance, one of our main mistakes is to believe that ISIS is a problem. No.
What?
ISIS is just a result of the problem. If we fight only ISIS, it's just like if we fight fever but don't care of the disease. No, we have to fight the disease. And the disease, what is it? It is the massacres being committed against the Syrian population. I mean, since the beginning of this revolution, over 300,000 Syrians have been killed. Do you know that the Syrian regime has killed between 7 to 10 times more civilians since the beginning of this civil war than ISIS? So it is our short view on this and our only focus on ISIS and terrorism because we are afraid of these guys. And it's normal because it is their job to terrorize us. It is this which creates the conditions for ISIS to be so prosperous.
You wrote that it is often enough just to cry wolf to create a wolf. Violence produces violence just as despair breeds radicalization and hate feeds hate.
You know, I've covered as a journalist not only the war in Iraq, because I arrived in Baghdad 5 months before the American soldiers, and I covered intensively the Syrian revolution. I've been there 5 times, each time for a long time. And when I arrived first in Syria, this revolution was very peaceful, very joyful. People were dancing in the streets. And I've seen this revolution progressively being militarized and radicalized.
Well, they were happy initially because they thought there would be some support like there was for the Libyan revolution.
And there wasn't. There wasn't any support. And they have been massacred. And I mean, I'm not going to advocate for violence. But this violence is somehow a natural reaction. When a friend of mine, a Syrian opponent, told me, you know what, if the Dalai Lama was Syrian, today he would be a jihadist. If you live among fear and mourning, well, you eventually look for some kind of revenge. It's just because you have nothing else. You realize how fragile is your life.
You say that the Western obsession with the jihadists, the security threat that they represent, comes at a very high cost because it allows the Syrian regime to get away with precisely the kind of brutality that you just described.
Yeah. And basically, what does it mean? It means that, yes, we have to fight ISIS, but we have also to counter the Syrian regime, because I don't know what the future of this country will look like. But there is one thing I know for sure. It is not possible to destroy ISIS as long as the Syrian regime is in place.
Another misjudgment of the Western media that you highlight is one that has been echoed by a number of terrorism experts, that we, in elevating ISIS to evil incarnate, We
serve their purposes. They put themselves on some kind of pedestal, like, okay, we are the very bad guys, we are the worst terrorists of any time. And this promotes them. Because if you are like a youngster from a western suburb and you want to rebel, well, you will just join the best bad guy of any time.
So we've got the Western obsession we have to deal with. This notion that the Syrian regime will in any way be helpful in the fight against ISIS is profoundly misleading. Our inaction is not dealing with the causes of the disease. So that's another
one. Exactly.
When you were in captivity, Jihadi John was among your jailers. Being face to face with them for so long, what do you understand that we can't?
These are very trivial.
They are very trivial?
Yeah. They are very normal guys. They're just like street kids, mostly. And this is my advantage on you. You see ISIS fighters only through the videos that they produce. But I lived among them for 10 months. So I don't buy the legend anymore.
Nicholas, I want to ask you a bit about your captivity. Simple questions, some of which aren't so simple. You don't want to talk about them, that's fine. But I just thought I would try, okay? First of all, how were you captured?
Very normally. I mean, like like any hostage, you know, like in a movie. Have you seen a movie with a hostage being taken?
Did they put a hood over your head and throw you in a car?
Exactly.
Seriously?
Just like this. Just like this.
Wow. Do you know where you were taken?
No, yes. I found the location on Google Map.
Where was it?
Well, that was a facility a bit outside of Reykjavik.
Uh-huh. What did your cell look like?
My very first cell was a bathroom, but I've been in over a dozen of cells altogether.
Uh-huh.
Moved from Raqqa to Aleppo and a bit in the countryside and then back to Raqqa. So they were good at making me visit the country.
Good tourism. Were you like chained?
Sometime, yeah. Especially handcuffed together with Jem Foley.
Had he already been in captivity for a long time? He seemed to be the senior captive.
Yes, he was.
Sometimes you were in a cell with as many as 19 hostages?
Yes.
And they were from different countries?
Yes.
How did you negotiate space? I mean, were there tensions? Did you guys argue? Did you talk?
Sometime we had a nice chat together. Sometime we had some arguments. Well, it's life. I mean, just try to spend 3 or 4 months with just 18 others, each of us having 1 square meter, and you will see...
1 square meter?
Yeah, 1 square meter.
You played chess?
Yes, we did.
How?
We improvised chess games. Steven Sotloff even made a risk game. So we
risk?
Played... Yeah. With a pen that we have taken from one of our captors and using small pieces of cardboard from packages of food.
When you think about your time in captivity, is there a particular memory or a feeling that jumps out at you?
I would say it's a long journey to recover from it.
You said that it really was kind of like the movies. And I'm just wondering, is there anything about your captivity that we haven't seen on the big screen?
No. It was just like in a movie. And by the way, even the people going to Syria, joining ISIS in Syria to fight, even these people see themselves as movie characters. They play their own movie. This is why I think that the most powerful way to fight ISIS are not bombs. It is to kill the narrative. We have to write another movie. We have to build other heroes. And this is why I believe that the French are making big mistakes in the way they fight ISIS. We created, for instance, accounts on the social media named Stop Jihadism. And this is like, they did not understand anything. And I did understand why we are so bad. It's just because in France, we don't know how to write TV series properly. Just because we have no imagination. We cannot just tell beautiful stories, create beautiful characters, beautiful heroes. And this is what we have to do. Because in our world, in our societies, what do people want? They want to become heroes. They want to be famous. They want to be recognized. And this is by lack of recognition that youngsters from our countries are joining ISIS just because they want to become someone. They want to be somebody. Our society don't give them a chance. So we have to create our kind of heroes. We have to kill the narrative, creating our heroes and not using the codes of the enemy. And we are totally failing in that. Even the TV reports that we are doing on ISIS, what do? We are just using their propaganda pictures. This is totally wrong.
Thank you so much.
Well, sorry for being sometimes a bit noisy.
Nicholas Hennin is the author of Jihad Academy.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's in a name if the name is genocide?
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Facing a congressional deadline and escalating criticism that the U.S. government hasn't done enough to combat the rise of ISIS, also known as Daesh, Secretary of State John Kerry walked to the podium last week and dropped the G word.
My purpose in appearing before you today is to assert that in my judgment, Daesh is responsible for genocide against groups in areas under its control, including Yazidis, Christians, and Shia Muslims.
And as the media seemed to say in unanimity, about time.
Next, Secretary of State John Kerry finally admits that ISIS is committing genocide against Christians and others.
Secretary of State John Kerry finally used the term after pressure from Congress.
Look at this. Why did it take the White House via the State Department so long to label this?
That's a question I can't answer. I think it's been something that's been mystifying to people.
Okay, now what? Does it actually mean anything? Rebecca Hamilton, a former Sudan and South Sudan correspondent for The Washington Post, calls this conundrum the G-word paradox. Rebecca, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get to the implications of Kerry's declaration, let's talk about how hard it historically has been for the U.S. government to pronounce the G-word. Here is then-State Department spokesperson Christine Shelley back in 1994, trying very hard not to say that word in the midst of the Rwanda genocide.
We have every reason to believe that acts of genocide have occurred.
How many acts of genocide does it take to make genocide?
Alan, that's just not a question that I'm in a position to answer.
True that that you have specific guidance not to use the word genocide in isolation, but always to preface it with this this word acts of.
I have guidance which I try to use as best as I can. There are formulations.
The genocide jig that Presser has been called.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it so hard?
Well, in that case, she was indeed following official guidance. Government lawyers had warned not to use the word genocide for fear that doing so might commit the U.S. government to actually, quote-unquote, do something. And they were referring, of course, to part of the UN Convention on Genocide, Article 1 of which requires states like the U.S. that have signed up to it to prevent or punish genocide if it happens. And so it was extremely difficult for her because she was desperately trying to hold this press conference where it was very clear that genocide was in fact happening in Rwanda without uttering the G word. Subsequently, that legal advice has changed.
So though we are signatories, we are not obliged to intervene even if we officially declare genocide is taking place.
That's the current legal position of the government. And this is subject to some debate within international legal circles. If you pass out the words of, you know, obligated to prevent or punish, different governments take different views on exactly what that obligation means. But at least domestically, it's very clear at the moment that the U.S. government doesn't consider that there are any legal consequences, as opposed to political or moral, following from a determination of genocide.
Well, irrespective of the legal interpretation of America's duty du jour, the fact is that from its beginnings 70 years ago, the term genocide has been fraught.
Right from its inception. It was a term that was created by a Polish Jewish lawyer by the name of Raphael Lemkin, who ended up losing 49 members of his family in the Nazi concentration camps, who as a teenager was obsessed with the impunity for the Armenian genocide. He didn't understand how is it that the killing of a million people is the lesser crime than the killing of a single individual. We have a name for that crime. We have the name of murder. But at the time, there was no name He heard Winston Churchill saying, in reference to the Nazi crimes, that we're in the presence of a crime with no name. And that really struck him. And so you can see in his journal entries, he's writing scribbles of trying out different words that could signify the worst kind of crime imaginable. And he ended up deciding on genocide, which was geno from the Greek word meaning group, aside from the Latin word meaning killing. And he went off into the world convinced, as us lawyers so often are, of the importance of words, and that if finally this crime just had a name, then people could respond to it with the seriousness that was required.
What he also did was create a new legalism,
right,
that has in varying degrees confounded policymakers and governments ever since. There is no playbook for how and when to invoke the word. What is it that is so confounding?
Even when we're at a place where U.S. government lawyers are saying, look, there's no legal consequences if you do this, government officials are perfectly well aware that in the broader public, it does matter to people whether a situation is genocide or not. One of the really interesting things coming out of the Darfur determination of genocide, which then Secretary of State Colin Powell made in September of 2004, he believed at the time, and I interviewed him a few years later, that by him saying the word, he would catalyze the governments of the world, including his own government, to effective action. That is not, in fact, what happened. But what it did do was catalyze this incredible response in the United States that became the Save Darfur movement. And for the next 5 years, Powell and everybody else in the Bush administration had these thousands of citizen advocates on their back because the situation had been called genocide. What we've seen over time is a narrative develop around the U.S. failed response to genocide, which really shamed American policymakers. Because of that narrative, there's a framework that's there for the taking in the media coverage. And we think to Christine Shelley doing the genocide jig and President Clinton's embarrassment.
We did not act quickly enough after the killing began. We did not immediately call these crimes by their rightful name, genocide.
All of that comes into play with the use of the word genocide. And so that can be useful for a situation that doesn't have already as much coverage as ISIS, but it also does something that can be a little pernicious. There's a sense that once something has the label genocide, we know everything that we need to know about it. So rather than figuring out the really messy history and regional context that is happening in the rest of Sudan or the Horn of Africa, for example, with Darfur, we can just draw this nice linear line from, let's start with ISIS today, back to Darfur, to Rwanda, Srebrenica, the Holocaust. So there's a decontextualizing function, in fact, that the word genocide now brings to media coverage.
I don't want to be too reductive about all of this, but if I were an Iraqi Yazidi woman, am I today any less under threat of being made a sexual slave by ISIS than I was a few days ago?
No. That, however, is not a reason to say that it doesn't matter that the Secretary of State has called what is happening genocide. It brings clarity to the policy process, which hopefully leads to better policies down the track. It focuses minds and resources. And at the end of the day, there is just a correctness about labeling something for what it is. And that stands through time, and it's obviously not nearly enough, but it is something.
Rebecca, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Rebecca Hamilton is the Deputy Director of the Robert L. Bernstein Institute for Human Rights at NYU's School of Law and author of Fighting for Darfur, Public Action, and the Struggle to Stop Genocide. Calling something what it is what journalists should strive to do, and what Turkish journalists increasingly are unable to do. A government crackdown on free speech has reached new depths in Turkey. Under the pretext of fighting terrorism, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has muzzled or punished reporters and editors, shuttered newspapers, or turned them into propaganda arms. This from a NATO ally and applicant for the European Union. Istanbul-based journalist Asla Aydintashbash says this is the darkest period in her 20 years of journalism. She used to write a daily column for the Turkish paper Milliyet and host a daily television show, but after the paper was bought by a crony of President Erdogan last year, she lost both of her jobs. Now she must be content to be a formidable presence on social media. Asla, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Bob.
There have always been red lines in the Turkish media. It's never been a full-blown democratic environment, but the red lines are getting thicker and thicker, more and more impregnable. Can you give me an example of what is simply off the table for discussion?
Sure. Number one, no corruption stories. Number two, nothing about the president himself or his family. And of course, the big no is the Kurdish story. We have a major war going on. Kurdish towns are now leveled. When I say leveled, I mean like Grozny was, the Chechenian capital. None of the mainstream papers picks up on it. They don't have reporters over there. They don't report on anything except embeds by the police or military forces. And if you look at the profile of journalists that have been fired over the past year or academics that are sent to jail, it's people who question the government's position on the Kurdish issue. For many of us, this is not a winnable war for Turks or Kurds. A better idea is to get back to peace negotiations. This is not something you can say on mainstream television in Turkey. I used to be on the air pretty often as a commentator. I used to have my own TV show as well, but I couldn't even dream of being invited to a TV show these days.
I want to ask you about the shutting down and reopening of Zaman, the seizing of the newspaper by the government. First of all, what happened there?
A government expanded an ongoing terrorism investigation. The court appointed a caretaker in charge of the newspaper. The editor-in-chief was fired. All the editors and columnists were fired. Zaman used to be Turkey's highest-selling newspaper. Today, I think the circulation is around 3,000, this from something like 650,000. Zaman is an interesting case because up until recently, those that felt the harsh treatment from the government were Kurdish journalists or leftists or lately secular opponents of the government. But Zaman happens to be a group of conservative Turks who have somehow found themselves at the receiving end of government's authoritarian tactics when they started questioning Erdogan on corruption charges.
And they are followers of
Fethullah Gulen, who's a moderate preacher who'd been living in Pennsylvania since 1999, I believe. He was an early supporter of Erdogan, but became increasingly critical, both in terms of Erdogan's personalized and authoritarian style, and because of corruption investigations here that the government is basically stifled and cracked down on.
And to Erdogan, he represents almost an Ayatollah Khomeini in exile in Paris figure. He may be in eastern Pennsylvania, but he represents to Erdogan's mind a threat to the regime.
So for President Erdogan, much of the criticism that's been levied against him is essentially either part of an international plot or a coup effort. For example, there was an urban secular uprising in 2013 around Gezi Park in Istanbul against government's plans to build a shopping mall there. And it was a massive, massive street uprising. And Erdogan called it a coup plot. Later that year, there were a string of corruption investigations. Again, it was a coup plot, so all the cops and judges and prosecutors involved in the whole thing were arrested, and they're now in jail. And now, people that are questioning Turkey's Kurdish policy, basically this sort of scorched earth policy that's been taking place in eastern Turkey are also part of a coup attempt to bring down the government. When you are willing to characterize all your opponents as coup mongers, you're de facto delegitimizing what they are saying.
So what is left? Is there real journalism taking place in Turkey right now?
Mainstream media is under a lot of pressure on a daily basis. What you have is, first of all, legal takeovers or investigations to suffocate either journalists or owners of publications. You have libel suits insulting the presidency, or the president is a clause in the Turkish penal code, and it's used very liberally. You have terrorism charges, particularly if you write about the Kurdish issue. But more importantly, you have a change in ownership structure. And here is how it works. A media owner realizes he cannot go on like this. His other business interests are threatened. So he would go ahead and sell his publication or network or newspaper to a crony of the government. And then they would change the editorial line and everything. Particularly owners that have other business interests, it could be mining, it could be tourism, it could be energy, you name it, are very susceptible to government pressure.
If this were a different time, it seems to me that Erdogan, he would be under an enormous amount of pressure externally, particularly from the EU, for clearly repressive tactics, for clearly undemocratic action and so forth. But we're at this moment of time where the West really needs a cooperative Turkey.
The paradox is 10 years ago, we were doing great in terms of reform and democracy, and Turkey was really leaping forward, and Europeans wanted to have nothing to do with us. And fast forward 10 years, now our democracy is effectively in shambles, but Europeans can't get enough of us because they feel they need Turkey to keep refugees out of Europe. Turkey is a candidate for European Union membership. The progress reports, just like the State Department human rights reports about Turkey, are terrible. But Europeans are willing to turn a blind eye to all of that. There was recently a summit in which European Union pledged to re-energize its partnership with Turkey. No mention of human rights, no mention of the deterioration of the democratic situation here. And instead, promised Turkey $3 billion in return for keeping refugees here in Turkey and admitting back refugees that have been going illegally to Europe. That's a very shameful deal.
Asla, I want to ask you about you. Tell me about how precisely you lost your job.
I wrote a column criticizing the president's harsh language towards media, urging him to not see all his critics as enemies, not to crack down on media. That was my last column, ironically.
Are you at risk staying there?
I won't say this is not an intimidating environment right now. I've seen friends go to jail. I have many friends who have indictments. A good friend, Can Dündar, editor-in-chief of Cumhuriyet, one of Turkey's oldest newspapers, has a trial this week. He was in jail. He's accused of espionage for exposing Turkey's illegal arms shipments to Syria. The fact that I'm not working for a mainstream newspaper anymore and the fact that I'm not on television anymore is actually something that's saving me right now. And I'm very careful what I say on Twitter.
Where you have like 500,000 followers.
475,000.
So you have not exactly been rendered into irrelevance, but I wonder how you pay the rent.
Well, the problem is, you don't know when you'll ever have work again. And it's not knowing that that's the problem. Everyone can put up with hardship and difficulty. And if this is a struggle for democracy, we can really pay a price. But what if it goes on for the rest of our lives?
Is there anything that holds out some hope for you?
Well, I think there are lots of young people who are struggling to become journalists. They're writing for online publications. But in my case, I feel like these should have been the best years of my career. I'm in my prime in many ways. And the fact that I cannot do my job is really making me sad sometimes.
Asla, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Asla Aydintashbash is a journalist based in Istanbul. She spoke with us from Ankara via Skype.
Coming up, a how-to for journalists covering Cuba. Think cars, cigars, and music.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
President Obama is happily at a baseball game, yucking it up with the Castro's communist dictators, rather than being in America, rather than traveling to Brussels and standing with our friends and allies.
Despite terrorism in Brussels and criticism from Cruz, President Obama went on with his scheduled trip to Latin America, where he became the first sitting president to visit Cuba in 88 years.
As President of the United States, I've called on our Congress to lift the embargo.
The two-day trip included a state dinner, a baseball game, and an awkward handshake between Obama and Raul Castro. Also, the usual hand-wringing that follows photo ops in communist countries.
But it's understandable that Obama played handshake defense, given how much flack he took earlier that day for being photographed in front of a mural of Che Guevara. Many criticized Obama as this was seen as giving an implicit endorsement to Urban Outfitters.
From Cuba, the Obamas headed to Argentina, where the first couple danced the tango. The president also had some pressing diplomatic business. He happened to be visiting Argentina on the 40th anniversary of the military coup that disappeared thousands of people, often dropping them alive from planes into the Atlantic or killing them in detention centers. On the heels of Obama's ode to free speech and friendly relations with Cuba, he vowed to shed a brighter light on the U.S. role in abetting Argentina's dirty war.
I'm launching a new effort to open up additional documents from that dark period. We previously declassified thousands of records from that era, but for the first time now, we'll declassify military and intelligence records as well.
But Argentinian journalist and author Uki Goni says that President Obama's overtures were snubbed by some, in part because they came at just the wrong time.
You know, the coup here is an open wound. The 24th of March is a very important date in Argentina, and there are huge demonstrations every year. So you have this unfortunate situation where Obama, coming here after Cuba, is stepping into a situation where there are extremely raw nerves. In Argentina, you have this group called the Mothers of Plaza de Mayo, one of the most important human rights groups in the world. I spoke to one of the mothers, and she said, "This is our date. What is he doing here?" The Mothers of Plaza de Mayo refused to join with them when Obama went to render homage to the disappeared. And the way that is done here, you go to the edge of the river and you throw flowers into the river, because the disappeared were mostly thrown into the waters of the Atlantic Ocean by the military. You know, there's a backstory here, which is that the United States during the 1970s gave support to the military dictatorships in South America, particularly the ones in Argentina and neighboring Chile.
There's one campaigner, Adolfo Perez Esquivel,
mm-hmm.
who was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1980. He refused point blank to meet with the president because of the sense that the U.S. has not come to terms with giving the green light to the Argentinian government to go ahead and launch this campaign of disappearance.
Yes, Adolfo Perez Esquivel, he's a victim of the dictatorship himself, you know. He was put on a death flight himself. They took him out for a spin, and at the last minute, they got a command to bring him back. And he actually wrote an open letter to Obama asking him not to come, which is an extremely sad situation because I was a journalist back then reporting on the disappearances here in Argentina, and it's very clear to me that thanks to the human rights policies of President Jimmy Carter between 1977 and 1981, the United States helped save probably thousands of lives in Argentina because Jimmy Carter placed an arms embargo on the dictatorship here. He sent special emissaries. Carter's special envoy for human rights, Patricia Darien, met with the head of the Navy, Admiral Massera. He's one of the scariest guys you could ever hope to meet in your life. She met with him at the Navy Mechanics School, where some 5,000 people were murdered. And she said to him, "I know as we speak that people are being tortured in the basement." He denied it. And she said, "I have the plans of what's going on down there. I have the layout. I know what's going on." And he said, "You remember the story of Pontius Pilate?" And he made as if he was washing his hands off the whole matter. So the United States really made a very brave effort at that time under Jimmy Carter to stop the killing in Argentina. And it's unfortunate that a Democratic president, from, you know, who Obama's pretty much in the same vein as Carter, was not welcome on this date.
So right now in 2016, what is the general perception of the United States with regard to the dirty war?
This has come up in my interviews, and something that gets repeated a lot is, so at first they egged on the killers and then they apologized for it. What are we supposed to think? It's probably not surprising that especially human rights activists in Argentina are not very impressed by anything the United States could say.
Now, Obama's promised to declassify a whole host of military and intelligence documents regarding the U.S. involvement in abetting the military regime. Back in 2002, some 4,700 documents were declassified, in which that secret meeting in 1976 between Henry Kissinger and Argentina's foreign minister revealed that Kissinger said, "If these things are to be done, you should do them quickly." Which reminds me of Macbeth kind of saying, if it were done when 'tis done, 'twere well it were done quickly, which apparently the foreign minister, Cesar Guzzetti, read as permission. So what are the new documents expected to disclose?
People here are quite excited about this. I think we can expect to glean a tremendous amount of information from those files. And, you know, the files that were released by Bill Clinton now over a decade and a half ago, some of those documents were used in trials against the former military officers here, and they helped get convictions. And those were only diplomatic files. Now we're going to be looking at CIA files, FBI files, military files. There might be things in there that could be very incriminating for the officers who are still on trial today.
There were trials, and then they were suspended, and then there was an amnesty, and then they started up again?
You know, Argentina, I think it's probably the only country or one of the very few which has put its own dictators on trial. At a very scary moment when the dictatorship had just been thrown out, when the military was still very powerful, you know, the new democratic government put them on trial and convicted them. Afterwards, amnesty laws were passed that made it impossible to prosecute lower-ranking officers. And then there were presidential pardons decreed for the generals that had already been convicted. So there was a period of time there of about 20 years in which we knew who the officers were who had committed these crimes, but they were walking free amongst us. Nobody was going to jail. They would appear on television giving details of what they did. It was a shocking situation.
One of them discussed the death flights.
Absolutely. Admiral Massera, the man who had met with Patricia Darien at the Navy Mechanics School, would appear on news talk shows and pretend he had done nothing.
That must have been unbearable.
It was, yes. But over a decade ago, all those amnesty laws were overturned and trials restarted. And since then, 1,000 officers have been put on trial and close to 600 have been convicted so far. And it's important that it happens as soon as possible. And hopefully these documents that the U.S. will declassify soon will help because the mothers of the victims are getting quite old. We don't have that much time so that not only justice is done, but that it seemed to be done by the relatives of the victims.
You've been to some of these trials. What are they like?
I've actually been a witness at two of the trials. I actually knew people who were disappeared. I worked at a newspaper called the Buenos Aires Herald, which was a small English language daily, and we became the only newspaper that was publishing what was happening in Argentina. These trials are, God, the emotional content is so high because you're having survivors of the camps, mothers and relatives, testifying, and you're having the suspects, the men who committed these crimes, sitting in the same room with you. So the atmosphere is quite tense, and it's painful for everybody, I think. At the same time, at last, justice is done.
Uki, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Brooke, and glad to be of help.
Uki Goni is an Argentinian journalist and the author of The Real Odessa, Smuggling the Nazis to Perón's Argentina.
President Obama's historic visit to Cuba this week brought with it the tantalizing prospect of a new era for Cuba's economy. The restoration of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba comes as economic reforms from the Castro government are already underway. Under new rules, last year the Cuban government issued nearly 500,000 small business licenses. As American tourists flood Cuba, Cubans are opening Casas Particulares, bed and breakfasts, and Paladares, in-home restaurants, in droves. But they don't advertise, not even with storefront signage. Michael Sorazio is author of Your Ads Here, The Cool Sell of Guerrilla Marketing. He recently wrote about Cuba's ban on advertising for The Atlantic. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What's the legal basis for an advertising-less Cuba?
Murky. As it was explained to me by a media professor at the University of Havana, the Constitution says that media cannot be used against the system. If you look at Article 53 of the Constitution, he pointed out that the Constitution protects freedom of speech and the press, quote, within the objectives of socialist society. The Constitution does not say that you can't promote products exactly, but it seems to be pretty clear that you cannot use the media to promote capitalism. So there's a fuzzy distinction there.
So what does it look like on the ground? It must take a moment before it dawns on you that there's something wrong with this picture, namely the lack of ubiquitous signage.
It does indeed. And I think that the introduction to that is the road from the airport into Havana, which is a space that in any kind of other capitalist economy would be just flooded with billboard signs. And, of course, in Cuba, there's a ban on commercial advertising on billboards. So what you see is an abundance of state propaganda messages, socialism or death, various homages to Che and Fidel, a number of public service, public health type campaign messages. But the utter lack of any sort of branding or commercial advertising messages in those spaces. There's similarly no advertising to be found on state television and the newspaper.
There is a burgeoning service economy, in-home restaurants and so forth. And there isn't really a means, I gather, for these small businesses to tell even neighbors that they're there.
That's correct. In-store advertising or storefront advertising is one of the most important ways of trying to get the message out, and it's simultaneously one of the most circumscribed ways of getting the message out in Cuba. To give you an example of this, I tagged along with a contact to her friend's printing business, and the entirety of the storefront was covered in colorful pictures, listed the store offerings, but the sign itself was a mere fraction of the entire storefront. And as she explained to me, that was a kind of formality should some nosy government inspector ever come around and bother the proprietor about having too much advertising on his storefront. He could point to the fact that the name of the company itself was very small, and therefore that was the only advertising sign for the business.
Did anyone go to jail for putting up a sign on their storefront?
The sense that I got was no. Fined, perhaps, but my sense is that the sort of repression that the state uses as a tool is much more inclined toward political dissidents as opposed to commercial aspirants.
Now, your specialty is guerrilla marketing, which exists primarily because traditional channels of advertising are too cluttered, too expensive. But in Cuba, because there are no mass channels of advertising, it's a way to get your message out without being in violation of the Constitution. Give me an idea of what people do to deal with the reality of the situation on the ground.
One of the biggest ways that advertising circulates in Cuba is through something called the Paquete Semanal, which is basically a distribution system of pirated pop culture content. Folks will go to their neighborhood distributor, their neighborhood storefront, and they'll bring a USB drive or a hard drive, and they'll download that week's worth of Hollywood movies, American and British TV shows, YouTube clips. And some video advertising will be affixed to the end of that content. This is really the only way, as best as I could tell, that video advertising exists in Cuba. Besides the paquete, certainly word of mouth is the main way that advertising circulates in Cuba. But of course, it's not deliberately strategized in those ways that we're hearing about nowadays in the U.S. When I mentioned to some of the folks in Cuba that you might actually pay folks to buzz about products or to stir up viral popularity for products, this was baffling to them.
There's something to be said for not being awash in advertising messages. In fact, you know, apart from Article 53 of the Constitution, is there anything about the Cuban character that will resist what is probably the inevitable ubiquity of logos and signage and commercials and everything that comes with the consumer society? Can we be sure that they're going to dive headlong into consumer culture?
No, we can't be sure of that. The folks that I spoke with were desirous of the possibilities of the floodgates opening in those ways. But even in some of the sort of conversational asides that I had with folks, it suggested that resistance certainly could be possible. Talking with a business owner who runs a bakery there, he was extremely excited about the possibility of trying to get the message out about his business. But when I spoke with him about the tradition in America, say, of having an advertisement interrupt a show every 10 minutes or so, he was mortified at that possibility. So there certainly could be cultural trepidation on the part of the Cuban community. And I would add, too, there certainly could be trepidation from the perspective of tourists. Rightly or wrongly, certainly American tourists view Cuba as a kind of preserve from the past. Things like the old cars, the old buildings, the kind of lifestyle that is represented there. But I think it's also partly due to the fact that there's not advertising suffocating you as you walk through the public spaces there. And if indeed the floodgates are opened, that will change Cuba for Cubans, and that will certainly change in many ways what tantalizes the foreign tourist.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Bob.
Michael Sorazio is Assistant Professor of Communications at Boston College. He wrote about Cuba's ban on advertising for The Atlantic.
Michael Sorazio is right. We do hold certain ideas of Cuba in our mind. So much so, in fact, that when you listen to Cuba coverage, you'd be forgiven for thinking there's a style guide specifically for covering this country. Well, if there weren't one already, we're making one now. First of all, how to describe the location of Cuba. You could say a small island in the Caribbean, or probably just assume that most people know where it is. But that would be to neglect the key factor of any Cuba story, namely its relation to the United States. If only there were a way to mention the U.S. while cleverly juxtaposing the geographical proximity with the ideological distance.
Cuba lies just 90 miles from Miami, but worlds apart.
The two countries that are separated by a mere 90 miles, but worlds apart.
Countries separated by a mere 90 miles, though seemingly worlds apart.
Countries separated by a mere 90 miles, but seemingly worlds apart.
Check. Now, as to covering the island itself, we'll need to dust off our Cuba reporting glossary. Luckily, there's just a handful of words every reporter needs to know, like the magic word that describes, well, just about everything about Cuba.
But just about every traveler that I've spoken to while I've been here notices one thing: Cuba's crumbling buildings.
Cuba's crumbling infrastructure.
Cuba's crumbling economy.
Cuba's crumbling coastline.
Cuba's crumbling capital.
The long-time media blackout that's about to crumble in Cuba. Charlie breaks that story right here.
And if you get tired of crumbling, mix it up with a heaping helping of decay.
Of the beauty and decay of Havana.
Some may see only decay and ruin here, but others see opportunity.
It's he'll move among the monuments of Washington and the gleaming towers of New York. Quite a difference from the decaying streets he traveled here in Cuba.
Why all the decay and crumbling? Because Cuba is no regular country. In fact, it doesn't even exist in the same space-time continuum as we do. Rather,
Cuba is a nation frozen in time.
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 The closest thing to time travel.
Island frozen in time.
Stuck in a time warp, thousands of vintage American cars still rolling down the streets of Cuba.
Ah, yes, the cars. No Cuba story is complete without a reference to their famous cars. And not just any cars.
Havana is known for its vintage cars.
Massive fleets of vintage American cars.
Vintage cars clogging the streets and slums lining the roads.
Now, obviously, Cuban culture isn't defined by only one thing. Actually, it's defined by four things. In addition to cars, they have rum and cigars.
Speaking of Cuba, rum, cigars, anyone?
A new era for the U.S. and Cuba, from politics to cigars, even rum.
Cuba. Come for the rum and cigars, stay for the human rights abuses.
And of course, music.
There is always plenty of action on the streets of Havana.
A rhythm-infused culture known for its classic cars and cigars.
Look past the grand colonial buildings with their crumbling columns and peeling plaster, and you'll find the city's beating heart.
All of which has made Cuba into something of a... What's that word?
Cuba has been this forbidden fruit for the American traveler.
This forbidden fruit of the Caribbean was a vacationer's paradise.
For years, it's been the forbidden fruit of Caribbean travel.
Cuba has long been the forbidden fruit of the Caribbean. History freeze frame.
Now, before you go criticizing the press, try to keep in mind, they can't help it.
Walking through the streets of Havana, you can't help but get the sense of being in a bit of a time warp.
Well, as you walk down the streets, you can't help but notice the classic American cars like this old Chevy.
So when you think of Cuba, you can't help but thinking about cigars. Cuba and cigars are interrelated.
That's almost it for our Cuba reporting style guide. Except one more thing, and it's the most important point of all. How you end a piece about Cuba. Obviously, you need music, but what? Something traditional sounding? But not too traditional, something catchy. But also recognizable to a non-Cuban audience. Something that just screams Cuba to non-Cubans. Something like... Buena Vista Social Club. Perfect.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mytha Lee Rao. We had more help from Dasha Lizitsina and David Conrad, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Rick Kwan, Casey Means, and Casey Holford.
And don't forget help from Rebecca Weiss. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.